All right, I'm here. I got all my notes. My friend gave me a handkerchief, so I'm prepared. So I'm really excited to be here and really blessed to be part of this program. My little girl has been itching to tell her story for a while, and I've been like, I'm not ready to tell our story. She's been like, well, I want to tell my story. She really wants to be heard and fully seen at last. I think that's probably why when I asked her what she wanted to wear today, she said, I want to wear pink. And I said, we don't like pink. And she said, I don't care. Like, it's not very practical. I choose my battles with her, like I choose my battles with my son, and I felt that I could indulge her. I wanted to thank you guys for being here to hear her and see her. So, thank you. I've also brought her affirmations because they make me feel safe.
So here's Let Go of My God. That's one of the first ones I did. I have them. This is a sample. I have them everywhere in my room, on my mirror, you know, by my clothes, by my bed, and they just help me. I have progress, not perfection, in front of the sink when I'm doing dishes. So sometimes when I'm like, that's too much, I just say, progress, not perfection. I'll leave those there for tomorrow. Take care of myself and let others take care of themselves.
I've started doing the promises. I heard someone say that if you take them and change them to I, that's very nice. So this one is number one, I will discover my real identity by loving and accepting myself. That's
my next project.
So I feel at home and safe no matter where I am when I have those with me. So that's why they're here with me. I figured I'd kind of break up my sections into we progress from hurting to healing to helping, because I thought that was a nice way to go. So here's hurting. So I came into the world pretty violently. My father used to beat my mother regularly when she was pregnant. My little girl, when I was asking her, you know, to tell her story, she was telling me, and you know, I struggle to believe this or not, but whatever. She was telling me that her first memory was of being in the fetal position and hearing yelling, and then feeling blows and like the impact, you know. And I remember just wanting my mom to be okay, and to want to protect her, you know. That's like my first kind of memory. My mother. So she liked to remind me throughout childhood that they struggled in deciding whether or not to abort me. So that was something that she liked to share fairly regularly, which I don't. Am I allowed to cuss? Okay, which is a pretty shitty thing to say to a kid, right? But my mom, you know, really embraced the victim role. That helped her with her, you know, with her stuff. So when she said that to me, I think that, you know, she really liked that feeling of power and control that she had that over my very existence, right? I think that's why she shared that, you know, so often. And for me, it was also to remind me that she had borne this huge burden to have me, and that was something I could never repay, right? Just in that one kind of story right there is a lot of my story. There's power, control, feeling of being a burden, violence, abortion, suicide, and, you know, in another way, a lack of God, really, right? Because she was saying, I had that power, right? It wasn't God, you know, that God didn't bring me into the world, right? It was her. And also, you know, to bring shame to me for my very existence, right? That was kind of how I took it. So it doesn't get any better. My first memory is of being sexually assaulted by my father with a carrot in the kitchen. And I always had this weird hatred of carrots, which I love Brussels sprouts, I love lima beans, like I love all vegetables. And I just hated carrots, which was like weird because they're like one of the most accepted vegetables that is there. So I was always like, why do I hate carrots? And then, you know, working through this stuff, this memory came back to me and I was like, ah, that explains that. And you know, honestly, I don't think my father really meant to harm me per se. He just didn't think of me. You know, he just didn't think of what that was. You know, he was kind of fascinated. He had this like strange curiosity about hurting people, right? And he loved to kind of experiment with his power and my vulnerability, right? You know, we were kind of, me and my sisters and my brothers, and I'll talk about that later, were kind of his like things that he could play with and make do things and then watch like what that happened, right? So I think it's fair to say he was sadistic, and I looked up the definition of that, which is deriving pleasure from inflicting pain, suffering, or humiliation on others. And I think that's pretty fair. He would do things like leave me in the shopping cart when I was 2 years old and drive off just to see like what I would do. And he would make us get naked in the backyard before we were allowed to come inside, even though the neighbors could like clearly see us. And when we did things, you know, that were, you know, too horrible to ever be forgiven for, he would make us get naked in the bathtub, turn the lights off, and make us sit in like 2 inches of water for hours. Like, why? What could we possibly have done to deserve that? It was just dehumanization, right? And then he also had the rock pile. That was also one of his favorite things to send us out to do when we had done something wrong, which was just to, you know, dig into the earth and pull rocks out and then throw it in this pile that we had. These are all really hard to say, but and then, you know, they thought they were rock stars, so, and they did drugs. I have a little section called Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll in here. So they used to have these parties, and I remember one memory of, you know, they made us get naked and touch ourselves in like front of this big group of people. And, you know, my sister was, I don't know, 3 or something, and she got a yeast infection, which, you know, children are not supposed to have, so I don't even know what happened to her. But stuff that shouldn't have happened, right? So here's the sex, drugs, and rock and roll section. So sex. My dad kind of thought of himself as like a demigod, right? He was definitely like one of these people that would be like a leader of a cult, right? He had this idea, you know, he was of German descent, so he was Aryan, and he was going to spread his seed, and, you know, so just a really horrible person, white supremacist, which, you know, is something that I'm trying to work on, my implicit biases that come from that, and so I have this book called Me and White Supremacy that I'm working through, so that's helpful. My dad got in a bad car accident, and his back was, you know, in a lot of pain, and we were on the East Coast, so they decided to move to California when I was 3 years old, and right as we were getting in the van to drive away, the neighbor girl jumped in the van with us, and my mom was like, okay, and that was the neighbor girl that he had been fooling around with. And so when we arrived here in California, I had my mom and my sisters and Mama Jane. She was with us, and we all lived in the same house, for when I was about 3 to 6. And my mom, told me that, you know, when she read me Goldilocks and the Three Bears, I asked her, well, there's Mama Bear and there's Papa Bear, but where's Jane Bear? Right? So I kind of had this, my idea of family, you know, and relationship was very confused, and definitely not the best relationship modeling. So, Quentin, my brother, my first brother, was born 9.5 months after my twin sisters were born, so that's nice. And then my father, when she was pregnant with her second child, beat her because, you know, that was his thing that he liked to do. And so she left before my second brother, Justin, was born, which turned out to be his death sentence. He drank himself to death at 26. And part of that, I think, is because he never knew our father, because his older brother, you know, even though he was only 2 when they left, knew our father and knew enough to be like, I don't want anything to do with that horrible, horrible person, right? But Justin never knew him, and he never got to feel that horrible energy that he was, so he always yearned for him and that connection, and he never got it, and that, you know, you can't blame any one thing on why people do the things they do, but I think that was a huge contributor to his inability to find peace here. So one day, my 2-year-old brother just disappeared without explanation. And, you know, there was no talking about it. There was no, you know, this was the little brother that I loved was just gone. And he was gone so much that I just totally blacked it out. And I remember thinking, you know, when I was probably like 9 or 10 years old, oh, I really wanted to have a brother. You know, I didn't even remember, right, that I actually did have a brother, right? It wasn't until years and years later. So my brother Quentin, the older brother, he struggles with bipolar. So my father probably also was undiagnosed bipolar. He couldn't hold down a job because, you know, he was so superior to all his bosses. So he would tell them, you know, within a week how they should be doing it. And so he spent a lot of time sleeping during the day, and we'll get into why. And my mom worked multiple jobs as a waitress, and at about 6 and 7, I started taking care of my sisters and cooking our meals and, you know, watching over them. All our money was spent on sound equipment and apparently cocaine, which comes to drugs, the section on drugs. So both my parents, you know, had these undiagnosed mental illnesses, and so they self-medicated. You know, I remember my dad would just sit down at the kitchen table and pull out the razor and the mirror and the straw and the white powder, and, you know, it wasn't until I was, like, in, you know, anti-drug, you know, in, like, middle school that I realized, like, what he had been doing. I just thought, you know, that's just what parents do. And I really don't have any memory of there being alcohol present, but I think it was just, like, there was so much other stuff happening that was just, like, not... I can't imagine there wasn't. And they used to, again, with their parties, make us, like, smoke pot for a chuckle, you know, that was, you know, just something to do. So I said the rock and roll section, they thought they were rock stars, so they were total music snobs. They had a CD and they performed at, like, local festivals, like the Strawberry Festival and stuff like that. But my little girl likes to listen to the worst pop music on the radio. The worst that I can find, I love, because it's just the total opposite of their snobbiness on that. I know it would drive them crazy, so yeah. So of course, at one of their parties, we were sleeping on the couch because, you know, who could put us to bed? And someone got a bad drug or something, and we were laying on the couch right in front of this big glass plane window in the living room, and the person jumped through the window, and there was glass and blood everywhere. The next day, my parents, you know, took pains to walk us around to show us all the blood spatters on the ground, you know, and to put in our mind that, you know, you never buy drugs from a blind man with a 3-legged dog. So these were the wonderful lessons that my parents were teaching me, essential life lessons. So even at that age, I was like, these people are not right. this is not right. So that's, I think, when my sleep troubles began. And, you know, I started to kind of have, you know, kind of PTSD-like nightmares. And, you know, that's been a struggle for me. But I'm starting to get a handle on it, so that's good. I'll talk more about that. So my father was also a rageaholic, unpredictable, doing things like keying cars, slashing tires in the 7-Eleven because someone said something, you know, in the line. You know, he wanted to egg our neighbors, but he didn't want to get arrested. So he, you know, 7-year-old me, he was like, you go egg the neighbors. And I don't know what got into me, but I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And that was bad. So my mother said that she would do it for me. But of course, she never let me forget that because, you know, she liked to extract a pound of flesh for everything that she did, right? So she likes to remind me that she saved me from that beating, so I should be grateful. My dad, you know, liked to remind us when he was punishing us that he had generously removed the belt buckle from the belt, so we should be grateful for that. And that if I had a bruise on my arm, that I was to tell my teacher that I fell on my block. And I still, to this day, don't know whether I fell on a block or if that was just what he told me to say. And I'm pretty sure that probably doesn't make sense unless that was what he told me to say because I didn't fall on a block. So our survival strategy, well, at least my survival strategy, was to play as quiet as possible and so that we wouldn't wake the monster who was always, you know, sleeping in the middle of the day. And to be invisible, and to do my darndest not to exist, right? My sisters, super lively, beautiful spirits, my one sister just refused, and she just, that's really sad because today she's untreated, drinks a lot. And she remembers everything, and yeah, and it's really hard, you know. I tried my best to protect them, but her spirit was too feisty. So I was about 7, and my dad was raging because he misplaced his paintbrush, and of course these little children, you know, who were terrified of him, they were playing with his things because we, you know, want to get beat. And my mom was getting ready for work, and this was the first time when, you know, I had been abandoned, you know, plenty of times before by her, but this was the first time where I had the awareness that this was a bad situation and that we needed help. So I begged her to take us with her to work. I was pleading for help and for protection, right, on behalf of myself and my sisters. And she was like, no, I can't take you. I remember watching her car drive away and being left with this monster and going, okay. You know, it just confirmed that there was no one to protect me, and there was no asking for help from anyone. They did a lot to isolate us as a family. My dad had a lot of paranoia. We would do things like, you know, you had to lay down in the car in the back seat so that no one could know that all of us had left the house. So every single time we drove out of the driveway, we had to be laying flat on the seat, right? Just had this horrible paranoia. So shortly thereafter, I decided we were going to run away. And we got to the overpass on a freeway on a hill outside of our neighborhood. And I could hear the cars kind of roaring underneath us and the wind in my face. And looking at my sisters, they were in this little red wagon that I was pulling them in, and they were terrified 4-year-olds. And just, kind of made the decision that the devil I knew was better than the one that I didn't. So we rolled home, defeated. in a pretty low place at 7 years old. But luckily, that's when my higher power stepped in, and one day a kitten showed up in our mailbox, and my father would have never, like, gone out and bought a kitten, but there was this kitten roasting in our mailbox. It was a really hot day, and so we got to keep him, and Samson would sit beside me, and I would just, like, sob in the garage, and he would look at me, and in his eyes, I felt cared for and loved, and he would purr and rub up against me. I think that was kind of the first time that I felt like love, you know? And that was definitely a higher power moment. So I kind of fortified myself, you know?
This is what I think of when I think of, like, my little girl, you know? And then here, and I don't know if you guys can see it, but this is definitely my sturdy little girl, like, that decided that she was...
All right, you know, Mom's not looking after us, and Dad's crazy, so I guess it's on me. So I started working on my mom to leave my dad. And at 10, she left him after he threatened to kill her. And he was definitely the kind of man that would be on the nightly news having killed his family and then shot himself in the head. He was, you know, that's kind of how I thought I was going to die. I remember, you know, being in fifth grade and telling my mom, wow, I'm in fifth grade. I thought I'd be dead by now. So that's, and when we left, I had to totally bury that loss. You know, even though he was horrible in his, you know, physicalness and sadisticness, there were moments, you know, he was bipolar, so there were moments when, you know, he had a bad back from the car accident, he would ask us to rub his back. And that was the only time when I felt safe and I felt actually wanted. You know, it was like we weren't a burden to him at that moment. So there were good moments with him, unlike with my mother, which we'll get into. So I decided that I just, you know, couldn't express my sadness to my mother. I couldn't turn to her and let her know how I was feeling because she would just turn around and go, take us right back. And so I didn't want to do that. So
I don't know if you guys can see in this picture, but this is, there's no light in my eyes anymore. That was like when I just totally shut down.
And that's when I started controlling things. This is when I started to keep a journal. So I was looking through my journal, and I saw a schedule that I put together at 12 years old. There was a 10-minute slot in there for daily dictionary reading. And I did, you know, have a slot from 2:10 to 3 o'clock, which was labeled, have fun. Oh, like a true ICAer. All right, so my mother was a total narcissist, and she used me as her sounding board, you know. So she would tell me everything, and the man that had helped us leave, my father, she didn't really like, right? But he had helped, so we were living with him. And she would tell me that, you know, after they had sex, she would vomit. Like, do you need to tell me that? You need to tell a 12-year-old that. So she was always, like, kind of on the search for a new man so she could get out of this situation. And so that's kind of when she just totally peaced out, right?
And so I have
some things from my journal. And this is what I wrote when I was 14 years old. Why doesn't she just stick a mannequin in my room and call me a daughter? No one would know the difference. Just a person to babysit, do well in school, clean, and is never in the way. I need a friend or someone to need me. No one here makes me feel special. I'm sorry my basketball games are an inconvenience. So that was kind of, you know, what my mother kind of considered me an object, right? I was there to be the, you know, the good student, so that she could look in society like she was a good mother. Oh, look at my daughter, she's getting straight A's. Oh, I'm, you know, such a wonderful mother, you know. I wasn't a person in my own right, which is why it was so hard for her when I got divorced, but I'll tell that story in a little bit. When I was 15, I discovered boys, and it turns out that was the beginning of my love addiction, which is something that I'm just recently coming to terms with. I'll tell more about that later, but this is what I wrote in my journal. My home life is falling apart. I want to settle down, relax, have some sort of permanent space, a place I can always be sure is there. I need someone to trust, a true best friend. And I could not handle Ben, that was my boyfriend, cheating on me. I need to have him so completely. I long for some sort of stability. I'm looking for it in all the wrong places. So even there, I was, you know, using that love addiction. And even then, at like 15, I knew that that wasn't right. If I use Ben for stability, what happens if we break up? I need his love so badly. I need to be loved. Am I wrong? Do I love him at all? Am I just using him for the way he makes me feel? Which, of course, the answer there is yes. So then, at 16, I was still with the same boyfriend, and he was angry for some reason, and so he forced himself on me without protection, and I was just like a deer in headlights. I just froze completely, and, you know, I didn't try to fight him off. I don't know why that happens, you know. I guess it just felt like I wasn't entitled to protect myself, right? Everyone else had not protected me, so I guess this is just, you know. So I took Plan B because I, you know, was worried, but I got pregnant anyways, and I was a vegan for that point at like four years, so I didn't believe in killing anything. I like wouldn't even harm a bee to get honey from, right? Because there would be some, you know, pressure or like kill a fish, right? But I was 16, and so I made the hard decision, and that was it for me emotionally. After that, I just completely shut off. I couldn't feel anymore. It was just it. I had no ability to feel anymore. So at 17, I wrote my first suicide note. I wrote here, I didn't do this to hurt anyone. I just wanted attention and understanding. I'm sorry, right? I'm apologizing even in my suicide note. Life is too hard to handle, which I didn't attempt. That was, you know, when the depression kind of started. Moved forward a couple of years. I went to the college that was the furthest away from home. So that was up in the Bay Area. And in college, I was on birth control, but I got pregnant again. And I had promised myself that that would never happen again. And so I was like sobbing, contemplating suicide again, and I was walking through some kind of, you know, tree area, and this light shone through the trees, you know, like when the light kind of comes through the trees, and I was just walking along the path and the light just hit right on a four-leaf clover. And that was my higher power telling me to keep on, and if I hadn't found that, I don't think I could have kept on.
It's something that I still struggle with in connecting with my higher power over.
So at 21, I eloped, promising I would do everything different. But of course, I had chosen to marry a man with undiagnosed bipolar, which, you know, I didn't understand until much later, or realize until much later. And, you know, I would continue to suffer through depression, PTSD dreams, trouble sleeping, more suicidal ideation. And during our marriage, we moved 13 times in 14 years, which people ask, were you guys in the military or something? I'm like, no, we were just running from ourselves, essentially, you know. We always had a reason why we were moving, but in reality, we're just running from the truth of you know, of our relationship not being what it would. So my ex was undiagnosed bipolar, so we'd do things like angrily drive off and leave my one-year-old and me on the side of the road and like shout out the window, "Find another father for that child." And I would like walk us to the bus station and get the bus home. And then I'd finally get home and he would say, "What should we have for dinner?" And it was just like, I didn't understand, you know, and it was like, am I supposed to just move forward? Am I the bad person if I try to bring up what happened? Like, he's already moved on. Like, I don't know. And so I would put up with that, right? I was willing to put up with that familiar, chaotic, emotional roller coaster. But I wasn't willing to put up with it for my son. And when my son was 2 years old, he started holding a mirror to me in front of me that I couldn't ignore. You know, children are like mirrors, and you can't ignore that, right? And he was two, and he's a very strong-willed child. So he decided at two that he was done with napping. There was too much to do. And I could not let it go, right? I had no ability to let go of my God, right? I was like, you know, I had to control this, right? I totally worst-case scenarioed, right? This not napping was first step in an unstoppable chain of events that would lead to him going to prison. That was totally in my head. Like, I couldn't realize the ridiculousness of that, right? I was like, I have to make him nap. So that led me to my first ACA bottom, which was straight out of my father's playbook. I took my son on the nap march, which is basically, he wouldn't nap, and I said, "All right, you're not going to nap? We're going to see about that. We're going to walk until you're so exhausted that you will nap." And I just kept pushing him, like, as we would walk, and he'd be like, "Mom, I'm tired," and I'd just keep pushing him, "Walk, walk," and there were people walking down the street going, like, "I don't know, should I report that woman?" And I even, like, pulled his ear to be like, to keep walking. And after that moment, I was just like, who have I become, right? I have become my father. And so I couldn't continue that chain. I come from 5 generations of alcoholics. I didn't want to see that happen to this precious, beautiful little boy. So I began going to therapy, and my therapist was insisting on self-care and setting boundaries with my husband. And so I started going to yoga for 90 minutes on Saturday morning. And that 90 minutes required a pound of flesh, of emotional toll that I had to pay. But, you know, I was used to that, right? Because that was what my mother did, right? So then we started marriage counseling. We went 42 times in 2014 because I am gonna make this work. I'm gonna control this. I am gonna continue. I am not going to break up this family. And so we continued for 2 years doing that, banging our heads against a wall. And finally, my ex was able to be honest when the therapist asked him, you know, if he really wanted to be a family or be a bachelor. And he came back and said, "I want a family, but I don't want to own the responsibility of a family." And that was pretty clear. And at that point, I couldn't, there was no more reason to keep banging my head against the wall. Like, this was clear that was his real, honest truth. And actually, I was really happy to hear that, because then we could start to move on. But of course, you know, it took a little bit of time, and then he had to threaten to kill me twice before I really, you know, took it to heart. You know, that's not reminiscent of anyone, is that? So, then we come to healing. Yay! Thank goodness we're done with the hurting section. So, we started our separation, and another higher power moment. A student invited me to come to the ACA speakers meeting, and I said, "Okay, I'll support you." I'm good. And then the first speaker was great, and I was like, "Oh, okay, all right. I'll try to come back next month, you know." Just so I came back next month by myself, and it was Esau, and his talk just spoke. I mean, so directly. And I remember just sobbing on the way home. Because I was like, God, I could actually get better one day. You know, I've been in therapy forever and been through all these depressions. And but there I kind of saw hope that things could get better. So I, with help from a sponsor, started setting boundaries. And of course, my mother, you know, seeing me as the object I was, just kept upping the ante. I would set the line here, and she would cross right over. I'd set the line here, and she'd cross right over. And I would say, don't come by unannounced, and she would come by unannounced with cookies at the door. Linus, I got cookies! Oops, I didn't want to say his son's name. I've got cookies here, like, come see Grandma! And I'm like, I told you, you can't just show up here like that. Then she, when I said, you know, you can't come by the house, then she started showing up at the karate studio, and then following us. And then when I said, you know, I don't need your help anymore with, you know, when I go to teach in Ojai, I'm, you know, gonna get someone else to pick up my son from daycare, but she decided that she would pick him up anyways. And then when I went to pick him up from her house, pretty angry. She's like, oh, come on, sit down, have a piece of pie. Come on, your son really wants to enjoy some pie. So she did a really good job of trying to get in between the two of us. Then, of course, there was a time where she tried to use her old key to break into my apartment, and she was, you know, with the key in the door, and it was like out of a horror movie, and she's like, I'm coming in, and like the door lock is like wiggling, and luckily, I had changed the locks. I thought I had changed the locks for my ex-husband, but apparently I had changed the locks for my mother. I knew there was something wrong when I asked the daycare provider what had happened with my son, and the story my mother had told me was completely different from the story that the daycare provider told me, and I totally believed the daycare provider. And that was a problem, right? There was a real trust issue right there. And then, of course, there was my birthday. Wonderful. I had a wonderful birthday. Everyone was saying, that's great. And I had, you know, decided I was going to go paint for my birthday, do a little painting class. And I asked my mom if she would watch my son. And a couple hours before I was supposed to leave for the painting class, she called me to tell me she couldn't do that, that we needed to reconcile, and I needed to grovel and get on my knees and apologize for my repugnant, or however you say that word, behavior. And I was like, no thank you. So I called my babysitter, and she came by, and I got to the painting class, and a couple minutes into it, I get a phone call from my babysitter. She's like, your mother's here. So she could be there, and she could see my son, but she couldn't help me. Right? Because that required a pound of flesh. Of course, you know, then I decided that was not okay. And she was doing things to Linus, which I, you know, I don't have time to go into. But so I decided that was it, she wasn't going to see us anymore. And then, of course, you know, she painted herself as the victim, and she's the poor grandmother, and then she started calling my ex-husband and, you know, talking about how horrible a person I was, to the point he still insists that, you know, she should be able to see him, even though it's clear that she would just be doing damage. But he still feels very strongly that I'm doing the wrong thing. So this kind of behavior would not be acceptable for anyone else in my life, but, you know, since I was used to being a doormat for my mother, I just kept trying to fix our relationship. But finally, I ceased contact with the help of a sponsor and threatened a restraining order, and that's when I could really begin to find my own self-worth, and I began to understand about boundaries, that I got to set the line, and then what people didn't respect that line, that there were consequences for that. And, you know, since I had been able to do that with my mother, I was finally able to do that with everyone else, right? Because, you know, in your head, you're supposed to be able to trust your mother, right? And you're supposed to be able to come to your mother, and so it was hard for me to push her out, you know, for that to have to be the answer. But I was able to build space to protect myself, and then my little girl began to come out. She felt safe, I started to have a dialogue with her. And at first she was pretty upset with me. She didn't trust me. She said, "Oh, you remember me today, huh? You're talking to me today. Well, let's see if you talk to me tomorrow." And that was about as much as she would talk to me. But I've been journaling every night, and I ask her. I call her Sunshine. I gave her her name of Sunshine. And I ask her, "Sunshine, you know, how are you doing? What do you want to do? What do you want to wear?" We've started to have a relationship. So I started working the steps, meeting my sponsor every week for lunch for an hour. Started meeting a fellow traveler and going through the steps. I was still doing my love addiction thing, things weren't working out with my boyfriend, and I was just in a pretty low place. And that was when I hit my second ACA bottom. So I was walking with my son in the grocery store, and we were just having a nice little walk. We were just buying stuff. And he kind of got this pensive look on his face, and like he had just like discovered something. So we weren't arguing. He wasn't mad at me. He was just kind of like thinking, and he was like, "Oh, I wish you were dead, Mama, so I could be with Papa all the time." And I was like, "Oh, you know, sweetie, I know you miss him," because his, you know, dad had not been pulling his weight in terms of, you know, being with him. But that was it for me, right? If my son didn't even want me to be alive, I didn't need to be alive anymore. So I called my ex and told him that he needed to make arrangements because I wasn't going to be around anymore. And he was smart. I will give him credit for this. He called my best friend, who is very no-nonsense, and she immediately came to stay with me until I could be admitted. And that was really a point where I had to really surrender, right? Going to the emergency room was so much shame, you know? It was really hard for me to admit that my sturdy little girl there had finally had enough. But I had at that point my best friend, my sponsor, a fellow traveler, so I had just barely enough to feel like that I might be able to be held if I fell. I also knew that I had nowhere else to turn and nothing else I could do, because at that point it was a very scary point when my brain just started doing loops in my head, when I was trying to think, what can I do, what can I do, what can I do, what can I do, and it was, you know, kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself, kill yourself. And that was the only option, as I was, you know, that was where my mind was going every single, and I couldn't get out of that loop. And so I knew I had to go in. And that was 5 days, and that was, you know, that surrender and that complete just falling apart and saying, "I am human and I can't do this shit anymore. You guys have asked me way too much to do way too much." And that allowed me to begin to build again. So I moved in with my best friend, and she used to say, "I'm the most important person." And she would make me tea in the morning and bring it to me. And I was saving money because I was living with her, and she said to buy frivolous things just for myself. And so I started. My little girl had finally come out of solitary confinement. You know, that's how it felt. And so I was just tried to be really gentle. And so I stopped running, and I would just walk on the beach. And I began to write every night, like I said, journaling, asking how Sunshine was, and trying to listen for her voice, trying to listen for that little voice. And I started you know, reading from the daily meditation in the Red Book, and meditating at night. And there was this, like, Deepak and Oprah have a meditation thing they do, and they were doing the chakras, and one of the chakras was safety. And I had suffered from a lot of hypervigilance, so that helped with that. And then I got on nightmare meds that helped with the PTSD dreams, and I did a lot of yoga and a lot of crying. And I had these super tight, like, hypervigilant back muscles that would never stop. And so I began going to a chiropractor to kind of help me deal with that. And then, of course, going to meetings. And then really starting to build my loving parent. And there was a moment when Sunshine really wanted to go to the library and get a book. She wanted to do it now. She wanted it now. And I was like, yeah, but we gotta go pick up Linus first. And she's like, no, I want to go now. And I was like, okay, all right, sweetheart, but first we're gonna do this, and then we'll go right to the library. And that was the first moment where I was like, oh, this is what a loving parent would do, would be acknowledge the desire, but it doesn't mean you have to indulge the desire every single time, right? I can gently say, I hear you, and I acknowledge you, but let's do what we have to do responsibly first. And that was really awesome, because then I was better able to parent my son. Then I also learned to let go of perfection with, you know, progress, not perfection. And I did things like practicing, like I would fold the laundry, and instead of putting it away, I would just sit it out on top of my drawer for like 3 days. And I would, every time I saw it, I would like start to get the shakes, but I would just practice, like, just, it doesn't have to be perfect. And so I started slowly to let go of that and become more aware of my compulsions, like cleaning. I would compulsively clean all the time, instead of dealing with my emotions. And just, you know, learn to be a human, you know, not to fight tears, and really, you know, sometimes just sob on the floor on my knees, and praying to God. Trying to develop a relationship with my higher power, which has been a struggle for me. But I'm working on it. And then learning, you know, that mistakes are okay. That you can take responsibility, apologize, make amends, and then you can move forward. And, you know, there was no forgiveness. There was no saying I'm sorry or I forgive you in my family. So that was really beautiful to discover that. And that really also helped me develop the ability to forgive others, because I knew that that desire in myself when I had made a mistake. And also, you know, being okay with anger. You know, this is something that, you know, you're taught not to feel, and not be allowed to own at all, especially if you're a girl. So I've been working on that. And then learning to let my little girl out into the world while protecting her. And then, you know, learning to ignore what other people think. Like this ridiculous outfit, like, I don't care. This is a sign of my recovery, this ridiculous outfit. And listening to my gut, respecting my truth, and then expressing my truth to others, because I didn't have a voice. But so now, like, it's really hard, but I'm learning how to do that. And then letting other people be responsible for their own feelings. So if I do my thing, you know, and they're not okay with that, that's okay. Like, that's their thing, right? And then, of course, not trying to help, right? Help, right? We're helping other people, right? But that's not at all helpful. And so, you know, I'm letting my sisters do their own thing. And then enforcing my own boundaries. I have 9 self-care appointments scheduled into my calendar every week. I go to yoga twice a week. I swing dance once a week. I have dinners with my best friend once a week. I go to my home meeting, and I have 3 fellow travelers that I meet each week, and my sponsor. So it's a lot of self-care built into my schedule, which is kind of amazing considering I have 3 part-time jobs and a son. But, you know, I've really prioritized that and made it work. And then finally, helping. So One of the most beautiful things has been the fellow travelers, you know, and the commitment to each other that we make. And then there's the gift of sponsoring, which is just such a beautiful thing. And, you know, you don't have to get through the 12 steps to sponsor. You know, you just have to be, like, you know, at least a question in front, right? You know, my fellow travelers, they call me because I'm still working on that 1,000-pound telephone. I'm really not very good with that. And I'm learning from their strengths. And I feel useful and part of a community for the first time. You know, we did a lot of, my family was always very isolated as a child. And one of my fellow travelers, when I was in a down point recently, said to me, "I love you. Does that count for something?" And that's really been incredible. Know that the people do love me. So recently my sponsor has told me that I'm not allowed to date, and that I am a love addict, and so I am working on that. I'm definitely identifying with that program, and I'm scared. It's a totally new journey, but I also feel a sense of calm about that. And I have more trust and even a little faith, so that's beautiful. And I have you all, my beautiful family of choice. And you see me, and you see my inner child, and you love me despite my humanness. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you.